I'm going to start by telling a little story about my early life. I was still a kid, really. When I was about 20, my younger brother had a really bad automobile accident and went into intensive care. And he was in intensive care for several weeks. As soon as I heard about it, I rushed out to the hospital where he was. And when I walked in the room, he was unconscious, and I just kind of see his body laying there on all the machines, you know. And to my total surprise, my first reaction is I had this flood of love and an immediate recognition, a clear recognition that if I could change places with him, I would, without any question. And this is one of the, I've told this story before, but this is one of the key points in my life, really. Because since I was a little boy, I'd been kind of groping, looking for God. But, you know, it's funny, I never would have connected God with that love that I experienced there. In fact, it was quite a while before I really did still. I didn't know what it was I experienced there, except that it was a revelation to me. Not just an intellectual revelation, but one of these blood and bones experiences that this love was just in me. And at that level, that there was simply no question that I would trade places with him if I could. And that's the kind of... Well, that can be, you know, if someone doesn't just forget it, you know, one of these, that inevitably is one of these really transforming events, because it really got me hungry, more hungry spiritually, and got me going more fully, although I still wasn't aware of what I was doing, kind of groping more desperately in the dark for the eternal, what we call the eternal, really. The Buddha nature, God. And again, it was many years before I really recognized the essential religious nature of that experience. In fact, at the time and for a while thereafter, I thought of myself as being, quote, agnostic, someone who didn't kind of believe in God and did not believe in God. But what I didn't believe in was the idea of God I'd been raised with. You know, I was in the process of a transition to something deeper and more experiential. Well, I was a monk a few years later. You know, Buddhist monk a few years later. And still, it was some years before the connection was made to love in that totally direct way. That as Reverend Master used to say, that what we call God or the Buddha nature is love, with capital L. By the way, you can't turn it around. I've said that too a number of times. You can't turn it around. You can't say that love is God. Things backwards then. And it is perfectly correct to say God is love. The reason why you can't turn around is because what we call the eternal is always more than anything that we can identify. You immediately start to limit it. You're not careful. You can't limit the infinite. It's also not a love that is owned by me or originates in me or possessed by me or created by me. It's an infinite love and an infinite wisdom. When you have been doing this training for as many years as I have, which is 30-something now, 36 or something like that now, which is, you know, most of my life now. It's funny how you can, I suppose it's true earlier on too, somehow you kind of take so much for granted. In a way, you kind of forget the, you can sometimes just forget the wonder of it that you first came to it with. And it's really always there. It's the amazing kind of infiniteness and incomprehensibility of, and the sheer inconceivable scale of the love that permeates the universe. And you kind of look around with your physical eyes, you know, and you see the seeming cruelty, seeming injustice of the world, which is only seeming. In actual fact, it's not exactly as it appears to be, and it still, it is what it appears to be also. And no matter how long you've been doing it, you're reminded that you always need to have faith in order to see things as they truly are. The thing about this love that I want to talk a little bit about today is illustrated in a metaphor that I've sometimes used. Imagine yourself with a fire hose, you know, hooked up to one of these hydrants that you see in the street. Now, the water pressure in those hydrants, if it's turned on completely, is immense, and that's the whole idea of the thing, that they can get a high-pressure stream of water conveying a lot of water in a short time directed at a fire. And you imagine that you're holding on to one of these hoses. I don't know if you've ever seen people, like the firemen, I don't think I've seen it on television, but, you know, using one of these hoses, and sometimes I have two or three guys on it because, you know, it's so powerful. Stream of water that's coming out, and it shoots way, way out there. And if you liken this love that I'm talking about to that high-pressure water, and you liken your own karmic dispositions and your own spiritual potential to that person holding the fire hose, and then imagine it's turned on and you can't turn it off. If it's turned on, you can't turn it off. What are you going to do with it? There's a lot of destructive things you can do with it, as a matter of fact. Something that powerful, you know, you can, they use them on rioters sometimes, you know, and you see pictures sometimes when they do that, you know, people being swept away by that water, knocked off their feet and swept away, rolled on the ground by that stream of water. You know, you could use it to destroy a house as well as to save a house from fire. When we talk about what's called the habit energy of the karma, what we're talking about is that love, the same love that we're talking about, that in its properly directed, properly used form is capable of so much good, of only good. But when it is misdirected, due to the combination of confusion and pain, when it's misdirected, it can accomplish so much ill and cause so much misery. You know, the reason why we train is to do something about the direction we're pointing that thing in. Because you can't turn it off. I should say that again. You can't turn it off. You can't help loving. And the more pain and confused that love becomes, the sadder it becomes. And the more desperate. And the more desperate it becomes, the more it lashes out in destructive ways. So if you look at the worst kinds of things that people can do, the worst forms of cruelty and the like, it's just enormously saddened, confused, pained love. That's why it's true, peculiarly enough, but you find this in your own experience one day, that even people who murder each other do it in love. And that doesn't change the fact that there are consequences of that which are horrific. So the reason why we do this daily grind, which is what it often seems like, of spiritual training, and the reason why people, some people, renounce the world and become monks, it's to try to get it right what you do with that stream that can't be shut off. And ultimately to return it to its source, for its source to use, to make use of through us, rather than for us just to come up with our own bright ideas about how it should be used. Or, at the lowest level, just be driven by the winds of our past karma into the old patterns, the old habit energy, which always leads to tragedy and misery. And however confused and pained, and however it may be misused, the essential nature of that stream is love. And it's completely pure. It's the meaning of that phrase some of you may have heard, there is nothing from the first. It doesn't refer to some kind of metaphysical existential statement. It's not philosophy. It's not cosmology. There is no real evil. There's only love that is misused, and by implication, there's love that can be wisely used. It can manifest in utter selflessness. By the way, to go back to my little story, you notice that I didn't change places with my brother and that it wasn't possible, and it's not possible. And it would have been a big mistake to try to do so. It didn't even occur to me to try to do so. I'm not crazy. I may have been confused at the time, but I wasn't crazy. It was just showing me something about the nature of the love that was there. And it transcended all the whatever pain and confusion there was between us, which was not all that much, actually. It may have helped me, incidentally, because he committed suicide a few months later, and I didn't blame myself, which is something a lot of family members do. judge themselves, well, if I had only been different, you know, done things differently. That thought passed my mind, and I went, I'm not going down that road. And that experience of love in that way may have helped me with that. When that stream of love is really stuck in the wrong direction, there has to be a really deep commitment to changing the direction. And there cannot be a counting of the cost that one of doing so, of making a change. And this is why the training that we're doing requires such a deep commitment, and why most people who undertake it don't, in the end, continue with it. So this takes a really deep commitment and something you know is that you're going to have to go through many difficulties, some of them very, very painful, in the process of getting things switched around, getting that stream pointing in the right direction. The traditional Buddhist way of putting it, one of the ways is to say that the habit energy, the karma, is hard to convert. You know, it tends to get fixed on the wrong objects and really fixed there. And then as it's played out over and over again on the wrong objects, it gets reinforced with its strength over and over again until it's really rooted in the wrong direction. And then deep suffering comes from that. The suffering's telling us there's something not right here. That's the purpose of the suffering. Signal and flashing. There's something not right here. You're fixed on the wrong thing. Some people try to take in the direction of saying, well, since you're fixed on the wrong thing, the answer is not to love that thing. And that's the mistake of asceticism. And it's not that simple. To understand the change, the nature of the change, you always have to go to what's called mystical religion. Because only in mystical religion is it is the experience deep enough to give any kind of mental clarity as to the nature of the change that has to happen. Buddhism when it's practiced properly, is a deeply mystical religion. The use of the word mystical here doesn't mean like mystifying in the way that the word is commonly used in popular usage. It refers to the transcendence of self and to the dissolving into or surrendering into oneness with the Buddha nature. And that's the essential nature of the mystical experience, is an experience of oneness with Buddha nature. Oneness with that love. Being part of that love, belonging to it. Being able to follow its lead rather than trying to possess it and control it. from the point of view of mystical religion, when that stream of habit energy is fixed on the wrong object, the thing is that what is a kind of gripping kind of position, and represented by a gripping hand, you know, called clinging, interestingly enough, you know, grasping or clinging, good words, right? Grasping or clinging. It's got to relax and let go. That one has to let go of that person, that experience, that world, that realm, that object of love. One has to let go of it. That's not the same as saying one doesn't love it anymore. It says that one has to get the self out of it and stop trying to possess and control. So because that always entails an element of, well, if I actually do that, really start to do it, I don't know what's going to happen. I may lose it all. At least I've got something, even if it's tormenting me, at least I've got something here. So if I actually were to do that, I might lose it all. Because of that, that's the major washout point in what we do. And in actual fact, we have to do it again and again. If one learns to think of that letting go as an offering back to the eternal, a giving the lesser love to the greater love, a surrendering a little piece of the whole back to the whole, there's any number of ways of talking about it. If one can bring one's heart to it, which is what I'm actually describing meditation here. I don't know if that recognizes you. You get so many kind of technical descriptions of meditation. This is what meditation is, actually. This is what meditation is. Surrendering part to the whole. That's what it means. Cut all ties, give up everything. Think of offer up everything. Not cut off everything. Surrender everything into the hands of the eternal. There's a beautiful phrase from the particular text that was Reverend Master's favorite and is my favorite of all texts on this process. It says, entrust yourself into the arms of the Imperial Mother. One of the seemingly rare, but not necessarily so rare, feminine uses or references to the eternal. But entrust yourself to the Imperial Mother. And that's meditation. And when you do that, you do it in the trust that the realignment that's necessary will happen of itself if you do that part. And if you then can live your life in accordance with that choice, keep making that choice in your daily life as well. Reverend Master used to say, the first step in religion is to get down out of God's seat. And that's the first step in true meditation, where you really begin to let it all go into the hands of the eternal. So often the talk about meditation, descriptive meditation, all about your thoughts. Like you were kind of, because Western people are like living in their heads. They're like, think, you know, heads on sticks kind of going around. Speech and mental processes. You know, and that's, you know, it's not. That's one of the reasons we do so much physical work in the monastery, at least in this monastery. You know, try to be one with our body and not just be always running around in our heads and have a misconception what this is all about. It has so very little to do with your thoughts. It has to do with your heart, your spiritual heart. and what it is fixed upon and what it is giving itself to. There's a kind of footnote to that, and it's often people wonder, well, what do I do about all these thoughts? Forget about the dang thoughts. That's not what you're here to worry about. You know, entrust yourself. Take a deep breath, sit up straight, relax into the arms of the Eternal, and let her rip, whatever it is. Don't sit there and play God. Get out of God's seat. For those of you who work in the world and whose job involves helping others, this is a key point. This is the key point. If you are the helper, you're misconceiving it. If you're just there to do a job and trust that the Eternal can use you as the Eternal can use all things, if you just keep your heart in the right place, then you get it right. And so often you get it right in ways that will surprise you. So here's another thing about the power of that habit energy, the karma. Since what its power really comes from is the power of that love, it doesn't need some fundamental fixing. It doesn't need for you to become some kind of spiritual super person. It just needs for you to train sufficiently in faith and humility that the Eternal can help you out with where this thing's pointed. And ultimately, as I was fortunate enough to learn very early in my training through experiences that surprised me, really, when you really practice meditating in daily life, right in the midst of the situations that you find most difficult, what will happen is that the element of misdirection or misalignment will start to convert, and that same power of love will start to be turned back upon the Eternal, the Source itself. And then there's all kinds of meritorious spillovers from this lake, and there's a fountain that showers its water all over the place. Everything gets bathed in the merit of that. Everything around you gets bathed in the merit of that. And this process, which is, I feel myself, I think it is the greatest mystery in the universe, really. And I don't believe anyone has ever really known how this works, but it's conversion, transformation, spiritual transformation. You have all kinds of descriptions of it, and I'm always talking about it, and I guess other people are too. But in the end, it's just a wonder. It seems miraculous. The closest thing I can come to a real explanation of it, and it's pretty remote at best, I think, is just that it's the essential nature of it is the love itself. Well, these are all things that, fortunately, one can prove true for oneself in doing the actual training. And you never have to just take someone else's word for it. I feel that I have been very fortunate in the course of my training because, in the early years of my being a monk, as young and confused and utterly ignorant about what I was doing as I was, I began to experience some of these things with sufficient fullness of experience to have confidence in them ever since. And I would really recommend to everyone never underestimate the power of even a moment's genuine meditation. And never think that meditation is somehow not working. Everyone who does this goes through protracted periods when it seems like it's just not working. And that's why you need so much faith. It's just that habit energy is deeply rooted in the past. Going back into past lives, some of them going back a long ways. And something so deeply rooted takes time to convert. But don't ever think the meditation's not working. And I recommend not neglecting the practice. A little practice done regularly. Regularity is vitally important. It is far more beneficial than occasional practice done in large amounts. A couple hours once or twice a week. Forget that. Habit energy is called habit energy because of the power of habit. Meditation is done regularly because of the power of habit. Make use of the power of habit. Build a habit of meditating. Then work at bringing it into your daily life.